Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists and authors, husband and wife team, Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, co-authors of the critically acclaimed Half the Sky, and their latest book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, an unflinching look at the causes of the spike in so-called deaths of despair and the declining life expectancy in America. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and writer Cheryl Wudunn here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and journalist and author Cheryl Wudunn, the Pulitzer Prize-winning husband and wife writing team, and co-authors of several award-winning bestsellers, including Half the Sky, A Path Appears, and the most recent release, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, a deep dive into America's epidemic of so-called deaths of despair. Cheryl and Nicholas, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Oh, we're delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, this book, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope, really takes us on this just incredible journey across America. But it starts in the small town where Nick grew up in Yamhill, Oregon, a rural town, maybe about 1,000 people. And you really framed this story through the lives of the kids who you rode the school bus with every day. Roughly a quarter of them have since died due to deaths of despair. So this book is very personal to both of you. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about its genesis and the scope of the problem you were seeking to illuminate in Tightrope.
Well, Cheryl and I would be traveling around the world, covering various global issues, and then we'd periodically go back to this beloved hometown of mine, Yamhill, where my mom is still on the family farm. And we saw a humanitarian crisis unfolding right there. So the five kids who got on the school bus right after me each morning were the five NAP kids, Farlan, who was my grade, Zeelan, Nathan, Keelan, and their sister Regina. And they were smart, talented, optimistic kids. Then Farlan died of liver failure after he was fired and then went into a downward spiral of abusing drugs and alcohol. His brother Zeelan died in a house fire while he was passed out drunk. Mm-hmm. Nathan blew himself up cooking meth. Regina died of hepatitis. And the only survivor is Keelan, the youngest, and he survived because he was spending 13 years in the state penitentiary. And it's just heartbreaking to see that unfold. And in some ways, they were outliers, but there was another family on the bus also with five kids, and four of those five are also gone. Hmm.
Well, I was thinking if you were novelists and you wrote this, we would think, oh, you reached too far, too extreme.
That's right. Yet
it's very real. These were people who were resilient and rambunctious, I think, as you point out, but smart and full of promise, and yet they could not overcome what we think of as the average childhood events, or ACEs, as we've started to call them in almost a clinical context. We would welcome you talking a little bit about the research that you've conducted around the impact of adverse childhood events on these so many other people in our country who are suffering as a result.
So ACEs are really critical to us understanding how people end up growing up in a troubled way. So for instance, if you take the example of Farlan, so Nick and Farlan were in the same class. They, you know, enjoyed the same kinds of things at high school. But Farlan, as we write in Tightrope, grew up in a very abusive household. His father was very violent and also used to not only beat the children, beat his wife, he would sometimes literally shoot at her with his guns. And she would have to run outside to hide in the dark because she was just too petrified to come back in lest he shoot her again. So you can imagine kids growing up in that kind of environment, they're surrounded by adverse childhood experiences. And we know that if you actually can you know, work with kids when they're young and they have had some ACEs, then we do have remedies. We have ways of using counseling and all sorts of behavioral therapies to address their situations. Most of us have an ACE or two in our childhood, but when they start to pile up 4, 5, or 6 of them, that's where it really starts to affect not only the development of the child rearing, but later on, they have determined that a lot of these ACEs also have an impact on your physical health. So for instance, later on, you're much more likely to have heart disease, to have chronic diseases like diabetes. I mean, of course, that's a terrible cost for the individual, but it's also a cost, a growing cost to society because costs on the healthcare system at large.
And yet, as you think about those 4 or 5 ACEs that you were talking about adding up, they really sort of make clearer why we have these deaths of despair. And you note in your book that there were 68,000 people per year have died from drug overdose, 88,000 from alcohol abuse, 47,000 from suicides. And yet you noted the contrast that much of affluent America is simply shrugging this off, paying little attention to this disintegration of entire communities across the country. I'm wondering, talk a little bit about the disintegration, the economics and politics behind the trend, and how corporations, as well as our government policies, have really failed to help reverse this American tragedy.
So one of the reasons for this crisis, for this great social depression, was the loss of a good working class jobs in places like Yamhill and similar places around the country. But that also raised the question of why did the Great Depression not lead to a similar unraveling? And in fact, life expectancy rose quite strongly during the Great Depression, whereas now it's tumbling. And we think that the answer is that in the 1930s, there were still a lot of institutions, strong families that buffered the pressures of lost jobs. And then gradually over the decades, these had diminished and declined and provided much less of a buffer for most people. And also, historically, there had been alcoholism. Alcohol, you can argue, actually increased social capital to some degree, while drugs just destroyed social capital. And so in Yamhill, for example, really the only institution, local institution, that was completely protective of its members was the Mormon Church.
Interesting.
And the only national institution that really provided a clear escalator out was the military. They had a pathway out.
Yeah. You know, I have to note, I've been doing a deep dive into some of the early research on ACEs, and, you know, these average childhood events have a profound effect on individuals who are not necessarily at the absolute bottom of the socioeconomic line. But then we imagine how much worse it is in the absence of jobs. You make some interesting comparisons in Tightrope between the American experience and that of other countries, and use the example about the GM plant closing in Detroit, also affecting thousands of workers on the Canadian side of the border, and yet those workers fared so much better. Tell us how you think that Canadians' continued access to healthcare and social services really made a difference from the Americans who'd lost their jobs living just a few miles away.
After the financial crisis, in the U.S., these workers got laid off, they lost their job, and they also lost their health care because the health care came with the job. But the lack of health care was an added stressor on the family, in addition to the loss of job and an income. Over in Canada, in Windsor, these people, they lost their jobs, but because Canada has universal health care, they did not lose their health care. So that just removed a huge stressor on the family. Okay. In addition, the government intervened. The local government looked around the area to find out where were the demands for different types of job opportunities. And they discovered that it was in nursing. So they quickly arranged for some nursing programs, retraining programs, to take some of these auto workers to go into the nursing field. And as a result, these people were integrated back into the daily workforce on a, you know, much quicker, you know, pace than in the U.S. And also years later, they're not entangled in self-medication, in loneliness, in depression that we so observed here in the U.S.
We're speaking today with New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and journalist and author Cheryl Woodham the Pulitzer Prize winning husband and wife writing team and co-authors of Half the Sky and their most recent release, Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. Nick and Cheryl, you know, I thought you really did a great service to the country of walking through this history of America's current addiction nightmare, starting back in the 1990s when the pharmaceutical industries was looking for this blockbuster drug to market to address pain, and which had been designated as the fifth vital sign. And yet you note that no pharmaceutical executives faced criminal sanctions for their really nefarious marketing campaigns for drugs like OxyContin and others. But then you tell this incredible heartfelt story about Geneva Cooley and what happened to her. And I'm wondering if you could just share that story and really about the broader impact of the war on drugs, which has led to mass incarceration of key populations that have been devastating.
Yeah, there is actually one update. So now the first pharma executive has actually been, but you know, in contrast, Geneva Cooley, this woman who'd wrestled with addiction all her life, had had deeply traumatic past and self-medicated, and then paid for her addiction by transporting drugs, was caught in Alabama, African-American woman, and sentenced to 999 years in prison. With a completely nonviolent history. And Geneva should not have been transporting drugs, but he was responsible for, you know, the tiniest fraction of the addiction and the heartbreak that groups like Purdue Pharma were responsible for. And I think if you look back at the origins of America's disproportionate problem with drugs, it's partly that we double down on the law enforcement toolbox to deal with addiction, while some other countries like Portugal, most notably, focused on the public health toolbox. You know, Portugal now, the number of heroin users has fallen by 2/3, and it has the
very
lowest,
impressive,
and the lowest drug fatality rate in Western Europe, while we lose at this rate 67,000 Americans a year from overdoses alone. And the other thing was indeed that pharma companies behaved just extraordinarily irresponsible in trying to concoct new big-selling drugs and marketed opioids to deal with backache, arthritis, and created institutes like the American Pain Institute to tell doctors that they were under-treating pain. And the pursuit of quarterly profits was just staggering. That was not present in other countries. Neither of those two factors were present in other countries.
But also, you could also argue that it was outright lying at that times when initially they were saying that these painkillers, they're not addicting. I mean, that is, and that was just, you know, an outright lie to say that they are not addicting. So it is something that we really ignore when it comes to larger corporations. We think that larger corporations, they're so smart, they have all these employees, they do their research, and, you know, they're just trying to sell products. Well, we see what's happening with Boeing. It's a great company as well, but, you know, they have to be regulated. And that's the thing with capitalism, is that capitalism is the best system we have. But at the same time, we have to set the rules. And when the rules are poor, we need to rewrite the rules. And there's nothing wrong with rewriting the rules. These rules should not be set in stone.
Well, I think we like to have a note of optimism and progress in our shows. And we are really appreciative that your book points to a way forward. Your title suggests that Americans are reaching for hope. You see opportunity for turning the crisis around. And you're offering both some large scale, but also some small scale personal interventions, things that all of us can do to make a difference. And so we'd like to give you an invitation to talk about some of these things that can have a big positive impact moving forward.
I think that, first of all, what we're really excited about is that this is sort of the age of innovation when it comes to developing solutions for social problems. Research institutions and academics all over the country are really trying to come up with great ways to address our social problems. A lot of private philanthropy is sort of funding the experiments. And and one of the ones that we think is really important, it's kind of a model that we think can be scaled or at least be adapted for other cities as well, is a drug treatment program. It's a diversion program for women, and it also can be for men. It's called Women in Recovery. It could be men in recovery as well. But basically what it does is it looks at women who are destined for prison sentences. Mm-hmm. It says if their underlying reason for the criminality is really related to an addiction to opioids or to some sort of drug, let's actually divert them from prison, because in prison they're going to sit there for many, many years and incur costs. And let's actually treat them. And in, you know, 18 months, 2 years, let's make them productive members of society so they can actually start, you know, contributing to the local economy. It puts them through a very, very intense program, psychotherapy, you know, lots of drug treatment, depending upon what the nature of their addiction is. It puts them through classes on morality training and, you know, business training skills, and gives them apprenticeships and actually places them in jobs, so that by the end, they do come out as productive members of society.
You know, one reason I'm optimistic is that there's just a much clearer sense of how we address these problems. And that's partly because other countries have addressed them, partly because some parts of the U.S. have. Now, we now know that universal access to healthcare is really important. We understand more about social determinants of health. And we also understand that public health is incredibly important, you know, in addition to just clinical approaches. We've done so well with auto safety, for example, because we've reduced auto fatality rate per 100 million miles driven by 95% since 1921. And that wasn't, you know, there was no one thing. It wasn't just seatbelts. It wasn't just airbags. It wasn't just padded dashboards. It was a million things. And in the same way, we can tackle these challenges before us, but it's going to mean early childhood education. It's going to mean child allowances, which are found in almost every other country. It's going to mean drug treatment. It's going to mean job training. And when the United States was shamed by veteran homelessness, then the Obama administration undertook a serious national effort to reduce veteran homelessness. Reduced it by half.
Yeah.
If we cared equally about child homelessness, we could reduce that as well. It's a question of whether we have the political will.
You know, you talk eloquently about this great divide that exists in the country between the haves and the have-nots. And I was just thinking of our own experience. Probably about 8 years ago, we run a large not-for-profit. We have about 1,000 employees. And Margaret and I made the decision about 8 years ago to interview every single person. And here's what we heard. 80% of the people say almost the exact thing. I've never met, let alone been interviewed by a CEO of any organization I work in. Can you imagine that? Just thinking about this divide that exists is oftentimes just simply about having conversations with people. Unless people connect with other people and hear their story as you did, you not only went once, you went back, you checked on people. We need to figure out how those who have the resources and the power can connect with those, because we're just tone deaf. And I don't think there's a substitute for figuring out how we get this larger conversation going across our country.
Those conversations are really, really important, because they also create greater empathy.
Yeah.
I think that right now there's a sense of otherness. And so people in the first, you know, up on deck, are they're having a huge party on the boat, and all of the people below deck are struggling with this growing hole in the hull. And ultimately that hole is actually going to bring down the whole boat. And I think we have to recognize that if we aren't all as a country going to try and address these problems, it's going to hurt the country as a whole. It already has. As we know, with a life expectancy in the U.S. has actually declined.
Yeah.
Everybody else's life expectancy among our peer countries is rising. But because this segment of the population, namely the working class, their life expectancy is actually dropping. It's dragging down the entire national average. Last year, we actually had an uptick in life expectancy.
Yeah.
But that's because we're saving people from cancer. Yeah. The underlying trend of the deaths of despair related to alcoholism and also drug abuse and also suicides, that trend is still there.
We've been speaking today with Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wudunn, the Pulitzer Prize-winning co-authors of Tightrope, Americans Reaching for Hope. It is an absolute must-read for anyone working in the field of healthcare, public policy, public health, or anybody that knows either of us. You can learn more about the book and their work by going to newyorktimes.com/Kristof. That's K-R-I-S-T-O-F. or follow them on Twitter at WuDunn and at Nick Kristof. Cheryl, Nick, thank you for sharing your journalistic gifts, for shining a light on humanity's many challenges and opportunities, and for sharing some optimism and a blueprint for going forward, and of course, for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for a great conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much. Continued success.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In the last Democratic presidential debate, Senator Amy Klobuchar accused former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg of flip-flopping on support for Medicare for All. Klobuchar cited a 2018 tweet in which Buttigieg said he supported it, quote, indubitably and affirmatively. Buttigieg says he supports a Medicare for All Who Want It plan, which he says would put the U.S. on a, quote, glide path that leads to a Medicare for All environment. As a candidate, Buttigieg has proposed a more centrist healthcare proposal. He does not support the Medicare for All plan proposed by Senator Bernie Sanders that would expand Medicare, which now covers primarily those age 65 and older, to everyone, creating a new universal single-payer healthcare system in the United States. Rather, Buttigieg is proposing an option for people to buy into Medicare through the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Those who are eligible would get subsidies to help pay for it, and the cost would be capped at 8.5% of a person's income. But it would not force people into Medicare if they choose to keep the private insurance they currently have. Buttigieg says his plan will ultimately lead to universal Medicare because over time he believes people will choose it. Klobuchar, meanwhile, supports a public insurance option built on either Medicare or Medicaid. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Here's a question for you. What is the last sound that you would want to hear when you die? Would it be this or this? That's the question the ambient musician and composer Yoko Sen asked after an illness led to an extended hospital stay. During that time, Sen was hooked up to multiple machines that made a cacophony of discordant and disturbing sounds.
I was terrified by the sound of alarms in such dissonance. Lying on a hospital bed, I wondered, why does it have to be this way? Could it be better?
So she set out to compose hospital machine sounds that would create a more soothing and harmonious oral environment.
What if I tuned some of these into maybe the same sound, just different tuning?
She founded SenSound, a social enterprise that's aimed at reducing noise pollution in hospital settings and creating what she's calling the future of hospital sound. As an artist in residence at the Johns Hopkins Sibley Innovation Hub, Sen has designed a multimedia tranquility room to relax with soothing music, moving projections, aromatherapy, and tea.
Staff members don't really have a place they can go to relax before the shift, after the shift, especially nurses. If we could help take care of them who take care of patients, ultimately, I think we are making everybody's experience better.
And Yoko Sen is driven to provide a better answer to this question.
What is the last sound you wish to hear at the end of your life?
Sen Sound. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.